Welcome to the Light Your Heart with Hope podcast. I'm Erin, and I'm so thankful you're here. My hope and prayer are that through listening to today's episode, God will encourage you and do immeasurably more than all you can ask or imagine. Maybe you feel like you're in a valley, looking up at the mountain of pain in front of you, wondering if you'll ever be able to climb out. You found yourself crying out to God, begging Him to rescue you. But what if it's the mountains in your life that birth a powerful message of hope that can help pull someone else out of their own valley? God has the power to move mountains, but what if they are the very thing that is moving you closer to Him, closer to His heart, closer to healing? In today's message, Jenna shares the story of her incredible son, Jackson, a boy whose life moved mountains without being able to speak a word. Jenna found herself in a deep valley when Jackson was diagnosed with Krabbe. There was no cure, but there was hope. Hope that she found in God alone. And it was through Jackson's life that the darkness of the valley began to lift, and she was able to witness God move in a mighty way through her son's life. Jackson was never able to move on his own, but God used his life to move mountains. Your story can move mountains too, when you allow God to move mountains in you.
We are from Fort Worth, Texas. My husband, Mike, and I have had three kids. Jackson, he is our firstborn child. We also have twins who are now 4 years old. Their names are Reed and Skylar. But Jackson and his story start before Reed and Skylar. As I said, he's our firstborn. So this story is really about him. And it's really about God's story through him and how God has chosen to refine our love for him and move us closer to him through Jackson in his story. In 2013, we had Jackson. He was beautiful, healthy baby boy. He had his newborn screen and everything came back normal and he was a happy little baby boy. There wasn't a lot to worry about. As he got a little bit older, we started noticing that he was doing some weird stiffening of his arms and legs, snap his legs back. We just thought, well, that's a little odd. And also just a few months into his life, he started seeming a little bit fussy. We just thought, is that colic? Is that something else? And, you know, when we took him to his PCP, she just said, you know, it might be a dairy allergy. And she had me cut out dairy because I was nursing him. And so we did that for a few months and it seemed to help a little bit. He was throwing up and just spitting up a lot. So we thought that might be one of the reasons why. And so that's kind of what we did. But we started noticing probably about 5 months old, he started daycare because I went back to work teaching. He got a couple mundane childhood and daycare diseases like bronchiolitis and an ear infection and things like that. So he had a couple of those back to back, right, as he entered daycare. We just started noticing that these symptoms of being incredibly fussy and him just stiffening his body, just recurring over and over again. We just thought, wow, you know, this is really, really odd. But you know what? He's sick. He doesn't feel good. That could explain a lot of the fussiness. But we knew his 6 month checkup was coming up in just a couple of weeks. So I was jotting down notes on my phone and just thinking, when I get there, I'm going to have all the questions. And then the other thing I think that was not typical that kind of sent up a red flag for me was he hated tummy time. Absolutely hated it. We would roll him on his tummy on his mat and he would just scream and he would stiffen his body and he just did not enjoy it. And he sometimes would do it and wear himself out to the point that he would just fall asleep. Should be okay with this. It shouldn't be painful or anything. So it was just another thing I added to the list of questions that I really wanted to answer. I took him in to his doctor's office for his checkup. And when I brought him in, I took him out of his car seat. He immediately was screaming and he was stiffening his arms and legs and he was like almost bending over backwards. And his doctor took one look at him and just told me, how long has he been doing this? And I said, well, like this, really the last couple weeks. It was a little bit before that, but it didn't ever seem to bother him. But recently, since he's been sick, it's been like the last couple of weeks, he's just been doing this. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, she goes, okay, I don't want to scare you, but this is not normal. She said, this is an indication that something neurological is going on and we need to see a specialist right away. Like you need to call a specialist as you're leaving this room. And my heart just sank. And I just said, oh my goodness, what? I didn't know what to think. She was just telling me, you need to get in touch with Cook Children's neurology. You need to find a neurologist. And I was blindsided, to say the least. I was here for a 6-month checkup. I was supposed to go back to work. I called my work crying. I was bawling. I said, I can't come in. There's something wrong with Jackson. I can't emotionally be there. I remember calling Michael and saying, you need to meet me somewhere for lunch. I went near his office. We met, we ate, we cried. And I was trying to get on the phone, everything. They said, you can't get an appointment with a specialist for a month and a half, I think was when we could get one. And then they also said we couldn't even get outpatient imaging done on his brain for 4 weeks. Like that's how long it was. They just said, you're just going to have to schedule it and wait. And so I was thinking, okay, so I ended up scheduling an appointment with a neurologist that dealt with the hypertonia and things like that, because that was what was recommended to me at the doctor's office. And so I did that, but it was going to be a month and a half out. And I remember the next day I took off of work again, because I was just a train wreck. And I remember, I can't wait a month and a half. I can't wait 4 weeks for brain imaging. I can't do this. I said, he is in pain. He needs to be seen now. I'm taking him to the ER. And I called Michael and I said, I'm taking him to the ER. He needs to be seen now. Something's wrong. We know something's wrong. His doctor said something's wrong. I want him to get help now. And so I drove to the ER, our children's hospital, Cook Children's in Fort Worth. And we went straight to the ER and they began doing a battery of tests on him. We were there probably 4 hours, I think, that night. During that, they were looking at metabolic things and stuff like that. They did a CT scan, I think, that night, and it came back clear. The doctor that was there that night said, I don't want to sugarcoat this for you. She said, I don't know what it is exactly, but she said, it is something neurological. And I want you to prepare yourself that your son is never going to be, quote unquote, normal. He's not going to be the typical kid. Like this is going to be something that is serious, that will be lifelong and impactful. And so once again, we still don't know what it is, but we are just shattered because that's just another gut punch. Oh, this isn't something that as simple as, you know, maybe we can medicate it and he'll be okay. I remember crying some more. And Michael and I remember us talking and saying, you know, maybe he'll just be in a wheelchair and he won't walk. And, you know, Michael and I are both pretty athletic. We grew up playing sport. I played soccer competitively my entire life. I still play soccer to this day. My husband, he was a competitive hockey player. He's played travel hockey. We both were just competitive athletes. And, you know, you have those dreams for your kids and you think, like, oh, I'll teach them how to do this thing that I love. I want to share this with my child. And then we were sitting there with this realization that, okay, maybe he won't be an athlete. That's okay. You know, maybe his thing will be that he loves to paint or something like that. We were discussing that, trying to comfort each other after hearing this devastating news. And they sent us home. They gave us some pain meds. I don't remember what it was. Quite honestly, it wasn't what he needed. We all know that. You have a leukodystrophy child, you know that, especially if they don't know what's going on with them yet. We took him back home. And then they said, get in touch with your PCP, give them the information. And so I called the PCP the next morning. I said, we went. This is what they told us. We still don't know what it is. They couldn't diagnose anything. They called me back and they said, pack a bag, go back to the ER. You're going to stay the night. They're going to run a battery of tests. And then you will get an emergency brain imaging done the very next day. And I was like, awesome, let's go. We ran up to the ER. And so we spent 8.5 hours with him screaming and crying and in pain and in the ER, them just running battery of tests. And it was so hard because they were poking and prodding him. They were taking blood. They were trying to do blood draws and they had to cath him for urine. And they did a lumbar puncture spinal tap, you know, to get some fluid. And for that one, they told us, you need to leave the room. You're not going to be able to watch this happen. And they tried to put an IV in his hand and they couldn't. They blew his vein and then they did the other hand and then they did the foot and they just kept. And every time we got him calm and relaxed, he finally fell asleep and he was finally resting. Someone would come in and have to do something else. It was necessary, but it was painful as a parent to watch it. Because he was so uncomfortable. And then they were doing these things to him that made him more uncomfortable. And it was just really, really hard to be in that room. And they did all the testing and they couldn't come up with anything conclusive based off of what they did. But that morning, the following day, we went in for the MRI. Initially, the neurologist that came in, he was going through the MRI slice by slice for us. He was saying, this looks normal. This looks normal. And he got to a place where it didn't. And he said something to the effect. And he said, now this is a little concerning. It could be an indication of something very serious, or it could be something that writes itself later on in time and stuff like that. So essentially what he told us, and it's all a blur, but what he told us left my husband and I with some hope that it was not going to be as bad as what we were fearing. And then we had a lot of family in town. We're both from Fort Worth. We have a ton of family. Both sides of our family live in Fort Worth. So we have deep roots in the city. So we had a lot of people in the room with us. We had maybe 30, 40 people in the room with us, all family. We were sitting there and we're all just kind of hugging, crying, just talking about what had transpired over the last couple of days and talking about our fears and things like that. And in walks a metabolic geneticist. She comes in and she says, I want to ask you a couple questions first before I get into what I think is going on. And so Michael and I were like, okay, the room was packed. And so we were like, okay, yeah, let's do it. You know? And one of the first questions she asked us, which was a weird one, was like, are you guys related in any way? I'm like, no, not related that we're aware of. Starting off right there, you're thinking, this is a weird question. And so start asking like, you know, about our ancestry and just some odd questions. She goes, okay, I know those are weird questions, but here's the reason why I'm asking. I'm 100% sure that what he has is what's referred to as a leukodystrophy. She said, but there's many of these. And she goes, I'm about 95% sure the one that he has is one called Krabbe disease. Unfortunately, it doesn't end in a good outcome. She just dropped the bomb like that. We had a room full of 40 people. There was no like, can we clear the room? You know, I'm about to give you some devastating news. It was just like that. And I remember just losing it. I just looked at her and I asked her, how long do we have? And she said, it's usually terminal by 2 years of age. And I was in there with my 6-month-old child. I'm doing the math going, I have 18 months left with my child. And then she said, I'll leave you alone to process this and kind of walked out. And I just remember being really angry at her for the bedside manner. I mean, you're going to give me news that I don't want to hear. And I get that. And she probably has to walk in and do that a lot. And she probably has to detach herself emotionally from what she's having to do, because that's a really hard thing to have to do. And if you get emotionally invested, then it'd be hard to do that job, I'm sure. But I just remember being so angry at her and just thinking, why does she do it that way? You know, and just being devastated and just realizing my child's terminal and having to hear that in front of all these people was just brutal. And then we stayed, I remember we stayed a few days longer because Jackson was like struggling to eat and it was kind of a failure to thrive thing. He was just in so much pain. And I remember them giving us like tons of paperwork, like just Google printouts of Krabbe disease, here it is. And it was all outdated information and they didn't really have a lot of good information for us. I mean, it was phenomenal, to be honest, that they diagnosed him so fast and accurately. They did a wonderful job of that. But when it came to treatment, they didn't have a clue. I think he was the first Krabbe case they had seen at that hospital to date. While we were there, inpatient, every so often, a couple doctors would walk in, not to treat him, but to look at him. I know that they would bring some of their student doctors in, and here is this case they'd never had before. And I just remember thinking, like, I don't want you in here. You know, my child's not a study or anything like that. He's a human being, you know, and y'all are just gawking at him and you're not doing anything for him. You're just coming in to stare. I just remember feeling a lot of anger and a lot of frustration at all of that, you know, and just feeling like they didn't know what to do with him because they didn't. They didn't know how to treat him, and they payment, like we saw all the doctors, you know, I think, palliative care came in. We had a caseworker, we had his floor doctor, we had a neurologist, we had the metabolic geneticist. You're seeing all these specialists, a pain management doctor coming in. You're just seeing all these people and you're just overwhelmed with everything, the news, all the doctors coming in to talk to you about their programs or their piece of it. And it was just, I just remember feeling overwhelmed and just devastated. There's so much to that story, but maybe people can relate to this. It's just, I lost so much weight in a week, the whole week that we were doing the whole diagnostic odyssey, and couldn't drink, couldn't eat. I was running on fumes. A lot of it's a blur, but for some reason you remember, there's certain things you remember. I remember being told, this is not normal. You need to go see a specialist. I remember the PCP's words. I remember the ER doctor's words of, you need to prepare yourself. He'll never be normal. I remember the neurologist coming in and giving us false hope and being angry about that. And I remember the way the metabolic geneticist came in and just destroyed our hope, you know, just brought it down. And just the stark difference between, this may resolve itself, to your child is terminal. And I won't ever forget those moments. Those are seared in my mind. A lot of it's a blur, but I remember those things. They gave him the wrong medication. They put him on the wrong pain meds. They gave him a, I think it's called a catapress patch, but it was like a, it was meant, it's an adult dosage. They told us the half the patch and fold it over, and they put it on his back, and it was used for something. I can't even remember what it's used for. This is how much of a blur it's been, but it was used for something else in adults, but they put it on him for pain. And he just, we took him home and he was just lethargic. He wouldn't eat anything and he wouldn't move. He was just like a limp noodle. I told Michael, I said, I'm going to take it off of him. I think it's going to kill him, you know? And I took it off of him and I took him back to the ER, and I said, and I took him back because he wasn't eating, and he got readmitted for failure to thrive. And we were there again for a couple of days. And once they took that off of him, he started to eat better and stuff. And so my intuition in that was right. Our people here don't know what to do. They almost killed him. Well, we were at the hospital on October 26th, and then they did the blood draw and they sent it off to get confirmed. And on November 1st was when we got the call that yes, he did indeed have Krabbe. It was just quite shocking and devastating. It's devastating to get a diagnosis like that, because like in my mind, as a parent, you think about all the firsts, you know, and all the things that you're going to get to share with your child and get to watch them experience for the first time. You know, their first steps, the first time they call you mama, the first time you hear your child tell you that they love you, watching them eat certain foods for the first time, or first day of school, first ball game, graduations and marriage and kids and just the whole nine yards, you know, and you think about all of the things that they are going to miss out on because of this diagnosis. It's the death of a dream is what it is, you know, and you have to mourn the loss of that. I did cry out to God and I said, God, why? You know, he hasn't done anything wrong. He's a baby. This isn't a consequence of a bad decision he made. It's genetics, the way he was born. That's why, you know, and you think about the things you've lost and you just think, you know, he deserves to have those things. And, you know, I heard God's voice, and it was almost audible. And I remember crying out to God, saying those things and just thinking, it's not fair. Why? And God said, Jenna, those are not bad things for you to want for him. Those are good and right things, but they're ordinary things. And what I have planned for Jackson is extraordinary. In that moment of clarity, God speaking to me and telling me that, I realized, you're right, God. He's not mine. He's yours. I'm not going to say that I still didn't struggle with being around typical kids and seeing them meet milestones that my child would never meet. But God, starting in that moment, began to change my heart. And he began to help me realize that I wasn't given a child that was typical. I was given an extraordinary child who was going to push back darkness with his story, and that God had amazing plans for him, and that he was born this way for a reason, and that God was going to move mountains through his story, and that if I would just allow myself to open up my mind to the possibility of that, then God would begin to also refine my heart and allow me to also be a part of the story too. Once I realized that, I kind of had a change in focus and it became a lot easier to be around people who had those typical kids and happy for them that they were meeting these milestones or getting to do these things, because I was given a special boy that was given a different purpose in life, you know, and that God was going to use him for great things. And he has. He absolutely has. And I think about my own life and I think about my life up until the point that I became Jackson's mom and how much I was able to be used as a mouthpiece or a tool to expand God's kingdom on earth here, you know, and to help push back darkness. And I think about how little I'd impacted it. And then I think about becoming Jackson's mom. His story has impacted so many people. And God has wooed people unto himself because of Jackson. There are people in my family, there are friends of mine that got closer to the Lord because of Jackson and because of his story, that they have renewed faith and they have renewed relationships. I had family members that didn't talk to God for years, but were on their knees crying out, Lord, please heal this boy. And God used that to allow them to come back into the fold and start dialoguing with him again, where they didn't otherwise. And I know that wouldn't have happened if he was a typical boy. He was a nine-year-old boy right now playing with my kids, you know, down the road with their daddy. It wouldn't have happened. God uses our sorrow. He doesn't waste it. And that hard things are going to happen. But it's not to punish us. It's not abandoning us. It's refining us. It's burning away those impurities. It's allowing us to see that we've got our hands clasped too tightly on the things of this world and that our focus is on the wrong things. And sometimes God will lovingly discipline us so that we will release those things. He wants you to live with open hands. These are good things. My son was a beautiful thing, but he's not the ultimate thing. God is the ultimate thing. And I needed to release my grip a little bit on that. And once you do that and you allow God to move, I mean, God's going to move without you. But if you say, yes, Lord, I want to be a part of this, and you open your heart to it, he will allow you to be a part of it. And it's a pretty awesome thing to get to be a part of it, be a part of the story, be a part of the journey, to watch God move in those ways, and just to see the Lord tangibly pushing back darkness. You know, it's just a wonderful thing to get to be a part of. It's restorative to your soul, because God's going to do things to bring himself glory, but also to bring you joy, true joy. And Jackson was a source of true joy in my life, especially when I saw that he's not going to be just like everyone else. He is perfectly made the way he is. He's made this way on purpose, and God is using him this way. And he is just a beautiful boy. And he was a beautiful boy. He was so beautiful. And there was a quiet peace about him. And it's just amazing. It just goes to God's strength to show that. And he's all about using weakness to show strength. The Lord is. I mean, you think about my son. He never spoke a word. He couldn't move on his own. And yet he moved mountains. You know, God was able to move mountains through him. And so you think about that, and it just shows God's ultimate like control and power over darkness and, you know, the hard things. One thing I know for sure is that God does not change. And so he doesn't change his mind about you. So if you're doubting or you're struggling, bring that to the Lord, wrestle with him. He already knows how you feel. Have a dialogue about it. Tell him you're angry. I told him I was angry, and he gave me profound comfort and gave me, he illuminated that very important thing, that my son is fearfully and wonderfully made, and that he is going to use him for extraordinary purposes. You know, but I had to wrestle and actually have that conversation with the Lord to get that answer. But God doesn't change. So if you are struggling, fear not, because he's going to love you through it, and he will not change his mind about you. You are his, you know, and you will be. And he knows how you're going to mess up in the future. He knows how you're going to make mistakes down the road. And he has not changed his mind about you, and he won't. You know, so feel that I hope that frees people up to have an honest conversation with the Lord, or even with the people around you. I think another thing is finding community. We do that so well through Hunter's Hope, is being able to find people who have gone through similar things, because it is a lonely road. I mean, I mentioned earlier that we were the first Crab A diagnosis at that hospital. And so there's no one around us going through this. That's what it feels like, right? But seeking out that community and finding people who are going through the same things can help you find comfort, make you realize that you are not the only one. And then there's people that are there to support you and love you through it. And there's people on different parts of the journey. I mean, our son passed away in 2016, and July 4th this year, it will have been 6 years since he's passed away. I know what it's like to get diagnosis. I know what it's like to stay at home and care for my Crab A child and do 100% of his care. I know what it's like to have sleepless nights and give meds and have to clean a G-tube and all of this stuff. You know, I know all of that. I also know what it's like to watch him suffer through apnea and all of that. And I know what it's like to hold my child as he passes, because I also did that. And I know what it's like to be in anticipatory grief, where you're living in a fog because you're trying to enjoy the time you have, but you're also mourning a loss that hasn't happened yet. And I know what it's like to actually lose my child and have to mourn the loss of them and not have them in my arms to hold. And so there's people in this community that can support and hold you up through some of the toughest parts. And they're all tough parts, you know, from start to finish till now. I can still just lose it at the drop of a hat, you know, thinking of my child and how much I would love to be holding him right now. There's all different people in different parts of the journey that are here to support and want to support, because it is a lonely road. It absolutely is. But finding understanding and comfort in those people can help you garner strength to push forward to be the best version of yourself for your child. I would say finding community and starting that conversation with the Lord, even if you're angry, just have that dialogue and be open and honest about it. Those are ways that you can start to look for hope and find comfort. I grew up thinking like, Jesus is going to come into my heart and I have to lay my yes down and say, yes, Lord, I want to follow you and make that decision to be a Christ follower, and then proclaim that to the world and start moving in action towards growing God's kingdom, you know? And I was like, Jackson's never going to be able to do that. You know, he's never going to be able to lay his yes down and proclaim that to the world. And once again, God so lovingly said, like, why can't Jesus snatch him from the fold? Like, why can't he save him? That is an arrogant point of view to put that limitation on God. Like, God has no limits. You know, I can't sit here and say, because my son can't verbalize that to the outward world, doesn't mean that Jesus didn't come into his heart and snatch him from the fold, right? I was just like, all right, God, touche. Touche. And I think that the fruit of Jackson's life is evidence that he is the Lord's, and that he was always God's, and that Jackson could have been having those internal conversations with the Lord unbeknownst to me, you know. And I believe that he was, and I believe that God took him at the right moment. He's allowing him finally to rest, and he's now, the veil is lifted and he's in a fully restored body, and it's a one that works, you know, and I bet he's got a lot to say, and I cannot wait to hear about everything he has to say. I want to know, you know, and I find a lot of joy and comfort in that. And I think about Revelation 21, verse 4, he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. I do not think that Jackson is in any pain. I don't think there's any tears. I believe that he is fully free. He doesn't have a care in the world now. Not a care in the world. My heart draws a lot of comfort from that, that he is perfect now. To me, he was perfect anyway, but he's in a fully restored body and he doesn't have any pain. There are no tears. There's no sorrow. He is where he needs to be. So I draw a lot of comfort from that. I know a lot of people, like when they're going through things, especially illness and stuff, it's easy to feel like you're either being abandoned or that you feel like you're being punished and things like that, and that this can't be a loving act from God if he's allowing these things to happen or transpire. I believe that like God will lovingly discipline his children, and it's, if you think about being a parent, you know, most of us are parents of, we could just free kids, but maybe even other kids, like being a parent, like sometimes you have to tell your children no when they think something's good for them. And sometimes in life, when we think something should be a certain way, but it's not, sometimes the Lord says no, but it's not to punish us and it's not to abandon us, but it's in loving discipline, because maybe we're holding on too tight to something that we shouldn't be holding on to. He wants us to rely more on him than us relying on ourselves or us holding on too tight to something that is finite here in this world. So like as a parent, I tell my kids no sometimes because I know something's not good for them. And sometimes we hold on to things in this world thinking it's good for us, but it's not. And also sometimes the Lord is not trying to punish us, but he's trying to lead us into something that is right. And so sometimes when you're being told something you don't want to hear, it's because there's something better for you on the other side. Sometimes we can't see that in the moment, but if you give it time and you pray about it and you look back on things, you see how God was moving and he was moving you in the right direction. And so I hope people can find comfort in that and knowing that God is for you and he loves you and he is ultimately about his glory and your joy and what's going to bring you joy, ultimate joy.
Will you allow God to move mountains in you? He wants to move the mountains in your life. He wants you closer to him, closer to his heart, closer to healing. If you want to learn more about Jenna's story and Jackson's life and legacy, you can find a link in the show notes. Join us Friday for our Immeasurably More mini message, where my mom and I will talk about the God who moves mountains. Thank you so much for being here. I hope that Jenna's story and Jackson's life encourage you to share your own story. You matter. Your life matters. And your story can make an impact that matters for eternity. Make a difference today for someone who is fighting for their tomorrow.